There is a secret that most pro athletes, elite CEOs, and high performers all know. They all have a group of world-class coaches working for them to help them optimize their potential. At Super Athlete Radio, our goal is to provide you with the caliber of world-class coaches and guests to help you unlock your potential, dominate your industry, and dominate your life. Let's get better today. And I'm really excited to bring on human performance coach Nick Shedd on Super Athlete Radio today. Nick, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. We were talking beforehand, before we went live here, about you were with Houston Astros before you were with the Boston Red Sox, and the kind of the strength of the Houston Astros player development culture. And I'm friends with Carlos Sophie Diaz, who is a mental performance coach for the Tampa Rays. And she's been on the show a couple times, and she's really emphasized that that is one of the things that gives them the opportunity to compete against teams that spend a lot more money. I was wondering real quickly before we go into your background, could you maybe share a little bit in terms of what you feel like Houston does that gives them the opportunity overall to develop players? And then maybe Carla talks about how Tampa does a great job in terms of developing coaches and people within. But do you have any specific things that come to mind that why Houston is so successful in that?
Yeah, I think being ingrained in objectivity and finding the things that are important and can you measure those things? How do you measure those things? And trying to seamlessly integrate them into training so that you're collecting data frequently but non-invasively. And that allows for a lot of fluid programming. And when I say programming, I'm not just talking on the strength and conditioning side, but really across all departments. And being able to allocate training economy to each individual's specific needs. And in baseball in particular, there's a huge need for physical development across the minor leagues. And that is something that was heavily prioritized there and certainly not the only piece of the success. There's a lot of great coaches, a lot of great people in different departments. But I think that was a bit of a separator.
And then is that because baseball players, you guys are signing them so young?
Yeah, so in the internationally, we sign guys at about 16 years old typically, and nowadays they're almost always sent to the DR Academy. Every MLB team has an academy there, and they actually have a season. There's two teams within each organization at each academy. And so you're taking guys that basically have become really good at baseball, typically with little to no physical development at all. And they're essentially high school age kids. So all high school age kids need physical development. But I think baseball historically has not placed a huge emphasis on the physical development side. And so it seems like the field is shifting in that direction, even in high school and college, but it's still not all the way there, like in the sense that football was. You know, I played high school football, I don't know, 15 years ago or more, and it was mandatory that you're in the weight room all the time. And you don't see that even still at a lot of colleges. And some of it's also the universities become, in essence, a win now league. And so we get a lot of guys out of college that are well-trained. We get a lot of guys that are not. And we're also still drafting guys out of high school that are still smack in the middle of puberty.
And then baseball has so many games. So ideally, if you, in terms of what you do, if you could wave a magic wand, would you have them lifting in the morning?
Yeah. Well, only because games, because games are at night. We want a fair amount of separation between the lifting and the running and all of the early work and the actual game itself. It's a difficult balance to make sure that guys are improving all the time, but also being fresh enough to perform, because you have to remember playing 142 games in the minor leagues also means getting evaluated at your job 142 times. And that's a big stressor to the players. It can't be ignored. If it was up to me, honestly, I would take all players that are below a certain criteria in physical development and maybe have them play games two times a week and just hammer physical development for a year and accelerate that. But that's not the way the league is designed.
That's interesting. And then what specific metrics would you potentially be looking to improve? I know it varies by position, but maybe if you just provide a couple of examples.
Yeah, so in baseball, I think it's kind of universally known now that hitting a ball hard is, as a position player, is going to be the most important thing that you can do. If you look at runs above replacement or WAR, wins above replacement for position players, the guys that are heavy on the exit velocity and on the OPS and all the hitting metrics side tend to have much higher runs above replacement, wins above replacement than, let's say, a guy that can't hit a ball very hard but is really fast, or a guy that doesn't hit well but is a really good defender. So that's certainly a priority on that side. Pitching, I think the philosophy differs more from one organization to the next. Most of what I'm accustomed to hearing is being able to throw a ball harder is usually a ticket to success. There's obviously an inherent risk every time you try to throw a ball as hard as you can. So there's a playoff there as well.
And then when you guys won the World Series in 2022, is there anything that stood out from a leadership perspective within the organization and or team camaraderie that really stood out that was potentially a separator for you guys, you feel?
Yeah, the camaraderie was there even before I got there, because there's a core group of players that had been around that clubhouse for several years. From a leadership standpoint, you know, one of the biggest challenges we have on the strength and conditioning side is if we're trying to monitor somebody's workload throughout a season and keep them healthy. In baseball, typically with position players, that means if they are getting way too much high speed exposure, that also means that they're hitting really well and they're hot in essence. And you want to go to the manager and to the player and say, hey, this guy needs a day off. He needs a little bit of rest. But nobody wants to pull somebody out of the middle of a streak. So that's a challenge. And having the leadership that was willing to listen to that and already intuitively know some of that stuff was really important. And, just being able to get into the season with the approach of we're going to try to slow cook these guys. We don't feel like we need to win every single game in April, and having the entire organization on board with that perspective allowed us to be better down the stretch and healthier as well. I mean, our injury rates were extremely low, and I think a lot of that was signal from the staff doing a good job and probably a little bit of luck on top of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then what were you guys doing to measure to say, hey, this guy, we know he's on a hot streak, but it'd be beneficial if he could take a day off tonight? What metrics were you guys looking at? Was it like a biometric wearable that you guys have these guys wear, or what? How are you doing it?
In the minor leagues, we use GPS a lot, but with the major league team, you can't wear GPS in games, and you're also not going to get a lot of those guys to add. There's a very strict limit on what wearables can actually be worn in games as per the MLB, and a lot of them just don't want anything that's going to feel abnormal or inhibitive. But now the markerless motion capture systems around baseball stadiums cover a lot of that. So you're able to get total distance, high speed running, max sprint efforts, and get a good workload. And in terms of early work or practice earlier on in the day, you kind of treat a lot of that as a constant. The major leagues have so much travel. It's a battle just to keep people fresh and ready to play every day, that the early work tends to be a little bit lighter than you'll see in the minor leagues.
And then what does that look like in terms of what you were doing? Were you guys collaborating after games to see what these metrics look like, or was it in the next day, or how would that look like from a performance staff perspective?
Yeah, it's mostly next day and with support from the sports science department as well. And that kind of trickles down into AAA, where you've got a combination of wearable GPS in practice and also the in-game data from the Hawkeye systems, and trying to combine those things and just getting reports quickly from the sports science staff, or having different dashboards set up so that you can make quick decisions as soon as you get in the building in the morning.
That's awesome. So what's sidebar here real quick, Nick? I'd love to hear a little bit about how you grew up and how you got into this space.
Grew up in Northern Virginia. I played baseball, wrestling, and football for the majority of my childhood, and I switched over to lacrosse when I got in high school. Regrettably so, because my high school lacrosse team was very good. A lot of those guys had played for a long time, and I was much better at baseball than I was at lacrosse. But I ended up, I really wanted to play football in college, so I played Division III football. I went to Averett University, and two of my core professors there were Dr. Lee Burton and Dr. Gray Cook. They're the two of the founders of FMS. And so that was totally by happenstance and was a blessing to me. I got a really strong introduction into human movement, and I was a sports medicine major there, somewhat on the athletic training track, but I didn't do the clinical hours because I was playing football. And I enjoyed the lifting side of things. When I was really young in youth sports, especially in youth football, I tended to be the young guy on the football team, which meant I was allowed to weigh more than everybody else. And so I think a standout through the youth football years. And then when I got to high school, I was a late bloomer, and all of a sudden there's all these guys that were way bigger than me. And so I spent a lot of my time in the weight room trying to figure out how I could get bigger and faster. And I think that kind of turned me on to the human performance space, and went to Appalachian State for grad school, studied exercise science there, and did a post-grad internship with U.S. Army Special Operations Command. And basically went into the private sector, and from there went into Olympic sports, and then found my way into baseball.
And then from your time getting initially instructed by Gray Cook and FMS, for those listening to this, with where you are now, these are not necessarily the elite athletes that listen to us, but maybe high-performing people who train very hard. What do you feel would be a good assessment for them to do, and what do you feel like potentially would be a benefit to that?
As in an individual athlete doing it on their own?
Or what direction that, you know, taking time allocation into consideration that you feel would be the most effective place to go do that, or, you know, method. Are you still a fan of FMS?
Yeah, I am a fan of the FMS. I think especially for general population, for large scale screening, it can give you a starting point. If you're really trying to solve problems on a deeper level, really affect like skill acquisition, as an example, you've got to enhance your evaluation tools be well beyond that, or at least work with people that have those skills. If I'm an athlete and I'm trying to test how I move, the first thing I would do is sprint, time my sprinting, film my sprinting. I think sprinting is a big indicator of a lot of things, movement wise and also output wise. And
that's really interesting. And then what are some things with sprinting that stand out that you usually see that could be immediately improved?
So a big piece of that is going to be the ability to actually adduct and transfer weight from one side to the next. And coupled with that is pelvic positioning. And then coupled with that becomes torso rotation, essentially the proper sequencing around ambulation. And for some reason, a lot of athletes lose this through training. And I think some of it is coaching. Some of it is a lack of coaching. Some of it is just through doing a lot of slow, heavy isotonic strength training and not doing enough sprinting, or I don't particularly love this word functional training, but doing things that are actually going to get them to move in different planes and solve movement strategies. And it's obviously an output measure as well. And I was kind of leading into also evaluating posture, but posture in a static environment is very different than the ability to control your posture in a dynamic environment. And when you're sprinting at high speeds, you're putting a big stress on the body to be able to do that. There's a lot of shear force on the pelvis. There's a lot of cyclical motion going on, a lot of rotation that's going on. We tend to think of sprinting as a very linear activity, but within the body itself, it's not. And how efficiently you do that can be a big marker of how efficiently you're going to move doing other things.
Yeah. One of our coaches here at Super Athlete is Dr. Michael Ripley, whose background is he's mostly in track, helped LSU win 9 straight national championships, helped 38 Olympic track and field athletes medal. And I swear to God, any high level track athlete or football player that would come to him, the first thing he would do is it's not like a regular foam roller. It's smaller. It's 3/8 of an inch. But he had him do pelvic tilts and tucks, and just seemed like every single time people are like what you're saying in terms of anterior tilts or anterior tuck, and it's such a foundational piece of movement. It's just amazing how everybody seems to have, without training, that has to have. There's a room for improvement there.
Yeah, something I found interesting working with high schoolers several years ago is I had them do skips, and I'm not talking about like A skip, B skips, track style skips, just literally skipping. I want to say it was a basketball team, high school basketball team, and I think maybe 2 out of about 20 athletes were able to do that. And I think it's something that my generation grew up, we played outside a whole lot more, and I'm kind of sounding like, you know, like get off my lawn, I'm the old guy, but I really mean it. I think there's a lot of things here that that we used to do like naturally and people don't do anymore. And a big loss component is like the rhythmic aspect of movement and moving fluidly, which means creating the right length tension relationships, being in the right positions, creating the right shapes, and being able to control your pelvis. I think anterior pelvic tilt was heavily demonized for a long time, and it's really a normal resting posture for a lot of people. But when you get into upright running and you want to see a more stacked, so to speak, position, a lot of people just don't know what that feels like or don't know how to get there without really hunkering down and squeezing their abs as hard as they can or squeezing their glutes as hard as they can. And it's just sort of a lost piece of athleticism.
And then is there anything that you took away from your short time working with interning at Special Operations in terms of how they went about their training or their mindset, mentality, or the leadership that you saw there?
Yeah, I would say I took away probably more on the leadership side than on the strength and conditioning side. I mean, I learned a lot because I was young in my career and still trying to figure out how to be confident in my programming at that point. But there was, I think, first the concept of briefing and debriefing after everything you do, being comfortable scrutinizing your own processes. And that's something that made me a better strength coach as I went along, but also being in leadership positions. Goes a long way, and the accountability piece. And when those guys are training, it was also, at least it appeared to me, very intentful, purposeful, deep practice, no matter what it was, because if they're doing it, it was important. And we're in baseball, we're dealing with a lot of young athletes. I mean, it's a pretty big spectrum, but a lot of what we're dealing with on the minor league side are young athletes, and trying to teach them the skill of mindfulness and deep practice.
And do you feel like you've been able to bring that into your programming in your weight room in terms of getting them to put full effort and full intensity into every rep for the majority?
I think so. It's certainly to scale it on a system as big as a pro baseball organization. We've got 250 athletes. You're going to have outliers on either end, but and honestly, coming here to Boston, there's been a system in place around speed development. I'll give a shout out to Ricky DeLuna. He's one of our coaches that's really been hammering the speed development side of things. And these players know a very impressive amount of sprinting mechanics and terminology because of the constant emphasis on this stuff and the constant deep practice. And then to be able to take that and relate it into the weight room and relate all of these things to throwing and hitting, it creates an intent and a purpose around everything that they're doing.
Yeah, that's the best way to live, for sure. And then how did you shift into baseball from your internship there?
So when I was, I went from my internship into, I actually was a volunteer strength coach at the University of South Carolina, Aiken for, I don't know, one semester, 4 or 6 months. I actually needed a full-time job, had moved in with my parents. They retired to Aiken, South Carolina for no good reason. I needed a free place to work out because I didn't have an income. And they had a really highly ranked Division II baseball team, and they didn't have any strength and conditioning programs. So I bartered with them and said, hey, I'll take your guys through workouts if you'll let me use your gym for free, and did that for a little while. And then I landed on my feet running a sports performance program in Richmond, Virginia, did that for a couple years. And then I joined Exos down in Virginia Beach for a year, and I really was missing the team environment. So I got into Olympic sports, ran the strength and conditioning and sports science for the U.S. women's national field hockey team for 3 years. And shortly after we missed qualifying for the Olympics, that tenure ended. And that took us right into COVID. So I was at the end of 2019, and I was working to get my next job, and COVID hit. I decided I wanted to pursue a PhD and enrolled in the University of Auckland in New Zealand, Auckland University of Technology, different school. The intention was to move there, but the visa process was shut down because of COVID, and it kept getting pushed back. And eventually I decided to try to continue that, but also go back to work. And it was honestly right place, right time with the Astros. Pete Petilla was the assistant GM at the time, and he was not solely, I don't think solely looking outside of baseball, but was keen to find a fresh perspective on the training. And it was a happy marriage, and he brought me in. So I was there for 3 years, and now I'm over with Boston.
I would love to go into a little bit into the weeds a little bit on some of your, let's not say generic, but kind of simple training philosophies, starting with, let's say hypertrophy. So if we have someone listening to this that wants to add, 5 pounds of muscle in 8 weeks, what do you feel are the most important things that they should do to be able to do that?
So you need to create metabolic stress. There's really two, it's all on a spectrum, but there's really two different routes you can go. You can go the moderate to low intensity with super high volume, and the bodybuilding world would call that more sarcoplasmic hypertrophy. The other end of the spectrum, as we've been finding out more and more recently, you can still hypertrophy down into the higher load, like 6 rep range. It's way more dependent on the volume within the session than it is the actual reps per set. An individual listening to this, I would say if you're new to training, don't worry about maximal loading. Work on the higher volume side of things. And as you become more highly trained, just know that you can work into sort of that strength end of the spectrum and still get hypertrophy as well. With most high-level athletes, we start to live a little bit more on that side and increase the amount of working sets opposed to increasing intra-set volume.
Okay, so you're looking at high volume, high number of sets.
Yeah.
You would recommend.
Yeah, like similar intra-session volume, but more sets with less reps per set so that you can load a little bit heavier.
Yeah, 100%. And then how would you look at food and nutrition in that?
Well, it's critical. At the end of the day, my job is to increase player value. And that starts with the on-field KPIs, like I mentioned earlier, hitting balls hard, throwing balls hard, running faster. And especially when it comes to generating momentum, which is ultimately what we're chasing, momentum of the bat at ball contact, momentum of the hand at ball release. That's how you throw hard and hit balls hard. Both of those things have a mass component to them. So you've got to get bigger. You've got to get stronger. And there's certainly cutoffs where enough is there's going to be a diminishing return on investment, but that bar is pretty high.
And then in terms of adding muscle, what do you think? 5 to 7 meals a day, certain amount of calories. What would you recommend on that?
I don't want to overstep with the dietitians, but yeah, certainly be at a calorie surplus. I mean, the tradition we're looking at is what's feasible is a half a pound to a pound of lean mass per week is what's reasonable. I believe that's the industry standard expectation. Several meals throughout the course of the day, making sure you're getting at least 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight per day. And that's obviously going to be on a bit of a spectrum depending on your body composition as well. And that's where I defer to the dietitians to run their calculations. But yeah, living at about a 300 to 500 calorie surplus a day is going to put you in a good spot.
And then we have a lot of super ambitious overachievers in this community. And so they should be happy with if they're making progress half pound to a pound a week of muscle.
Yes. And the older you get, the harder that gets. The more well-trained you get, the harder that gets as well. I mean, if you're brand new to lifting, you can expect your strength levels to double very quickly. It doesn't mean you're going to put on a ton of size very quickly, but the consistency of the nutrition is what's critical. I mean, we see guys get sick and they lose 5 pounds very, very quickly. And sometimes it's a hydration issue and it comes back very quickly. Sometimes it doesn't. I think first is like consistency of the nutrition side. And second to that is doing everything you can to optimize your immune system and stay healthy, stay hydrated.
Yeah, I think it's very underappreciated how connected the immune system is with our ability to get the training adaptation that we want. And then from a leadership perspective, what are you guys doing to, how are you able to communicate to all these young guys the importance of being consistent and eating this amount and doing it day in and day out where, you know, they might not see immediate benefit? Is there any particular strategies that you use that you have found to be effective?
Aligning messaging across departments. If you have a hitting department that doesn't think that guys need to get bigger or doesn't know that a guy has a weight gain goal and they're not echoing that message, at the end of the day, the players want to impress the baseball coaches. They don't want to impress the dietitian or the strength coaches. So we really need to leverage those departments, the on-field departments, to echo the same messages that we are. And these guys get thrown into a ton of meetings. They have very different levels of education across the spectrum. So it's more about frequent touch points, less about sitting down for an hour in a classroom. And then also closing the feedback loop with their data, showing them when things are going well, how that's impacting their power output on the force plates, how that's impacting their on-field performance, and making sure that we're constantly feeding that back to them so that when things don't go well, we can show them what initially led to success and get back on track.
In terms of the organization, what are some things that you saw in terms of like best practices that work to get everybody in alignment so everyone's preaching the same message? And I'm guessing it can't be too many messages, right, Scott, or things would get lost in the weeds.
Yeah. So it takes a top down and a bottom up approach. Like every staff member has to be bought into that and value it. And I think Craig Breslow here, our GM, has done an excellent job of that so far in getting all departments aligned in the thought process. It's very similar to what I alluded to earlier. Making sure that we are identifying what is important, how can we measure it, and then sort of using reductionist thinking down to diagnosing problems at a very granular level and being targeted in our approaches to attack those things. So that's number one. And also knowing as a strength coach, my job is to support what the front office and what the on-field coaches tell me is important to performance. So, you know, it's yes, a lot of our guys need to get bigger and stronger, but it is not for the purpose of getting bigger and stronger. It is for the purpose of being better at certain baseball actions. And by virtue of that, then you kind of go into educating and having conversations cross-departmentally about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and making sure that that message gets spread around.
Yeah, that's so good to be able to know really these are the specific things that we value. This is why they're important. And this is what we're going to do to improve those things. Man, if you can figure that out as an organization, that's a huge deal.
Exactly. I mean, our director of pitching is telling most of his guys that need to throw harder. You need to get in the weight room more. You need to eat more. If guys aren't eating enough, or they're missing the weight gain shakes that the dietitians are making for them, they're helping echo those messages because they really do believe it's important. And I think all of our departments would suffer greatly without the impact of the nutrition department. They don't get enough love because they're, I think, further, or at least viewed as further removed from the on-field piece, but they really support every single department that we have here.
Mm. Shout out to all those nutritionists out there. Okay, so like the three big metrics that we look at, and just like we're talking about here in terms of, all right, what's important in terms of physical metrics for our community, are relative strength, grip strength, and VO2 max, because there's also a longevity benefit that correlates along with day-to-day performance. And of course, being in professional baseball, want to get these guys bigger, but also you don't want to hurt their athleticism and their speed. So I'm guessing relative strength is probably a huge component of what you guys do. What do you feel like are the best ways to improve relative strength from a weight room perspective? Maybe potential exercises that you have found most effective or best ways to measure?
Well, I would start with, like, it depends on the individual. Some guys, it's just they need to improve their body composition and lose body fat. Some guys, your ectomorphs certainly need to gain a lot of lean mass and just become more powerful. And it also kind of depends on where they're at in biological maturation. Because we see some guys, you know, if you're just chasing mass and max strength, they also improve in relative strength just because they have a low training age and a low biological age. But I don't shy away from, I don't put myself into any one camp in terms of like unilateral exercises, bilateral exercises, anything like that. At the end of the day, it requires high intensity, moderate to high volume. Some of the research is also showing lower rest periods, but basically stressing large muscle masses to get acute spikes in testosterone and other anabolic factors and also cortisol as well. People often forget, I think cortisol gets demonized, but in total absence of cortisol, there's also really no hypertrophy as well. So you need to apply stress and then you need to remove stress. So we stress our guys pretty hard in the weight room. We do all of the big major compound lifts. We do some stuff that's more geared towards specific skill development. We try to really be in alignment with the on-field coaches in terms of consolidating stress, making sure recovery days are recovery days across the board so we avoid training monotony and we don't have chronically high cortisol and chronically low testosterone. But the undulation of training and the application of stress and not shying away from high stress is really, excuse me, really important.
And just to emphasize, I think it's really important for people listening to this. It's better from a cortisol and testosterone perspective, and potentially for a training adaptation perspective, to maybe go hard, you know, twice a day and then having a day off rather than going hard one and then continuously going hard day after day with less sessions. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. And we almost treat our baseball games as a constant. I mean, you can't forget about the impact of spending that much time on your feet in terms of fatigue, but the variability from one game to the next is relatively low. As an example, I want to say it was in 2022, Miles Straw with the Guardians had the most competitive plays per player in the MLB, and he averaged like 0.8 competitive plays per game. The difference between a really hard game and a really light game in terms of like high speed running is relatively minimal. And now they have the pitch clock, so a lot of games are around 2.5 hours, give or take. You're avoiding like the extreme ends of like 5 hour games and whatnot. So we treat that as a relative constant, and we try to undulate the rest of the load that we're applying around that. But you also have to keep in mind there is a chronic stress factor at play there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I never thought about it that way. So do you feel like the body is it adapts to standing on your feet for 2.5-3 hours every night with short bursts, you see, however many competitive plays per night, and the body adapts where it's soon able to be less of a load on the body?
The body does adapt, and typically in the minor leagues, we don't have guys play every day for 2 weeks straight, but sometimes it does happen, and that becomes an interesting conversation with load management. Like, you want guys to get maintain a certain amount of high speed exposure throughout the week, hit certain numbers. But if a guy is having a bunch of really low games, they're not getting a lot of hits at the plate, but now they've played 13, 14 games in a row, that is still a stressor that they are not accustomed to. And they will tell you they are tired, even if the GPS output looks relatively normal or even low to them.
Mm. And then on that note, if I understand correctly, you looked at this university at New Zealand specifically to get into their program that looked at sleep. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was their sport and exercise sport and exercise science program. I was mostly interested in sleep. Felt like I kind of reached a point in my career with our women's national field hockey team where I felt like my ability to program and affect change on that side was becoming more limited by off-field factors than the actual programming itself. And so we started diving pretty heavily into the sleep stuff there, and just kind of piqued my interest in it as I went down rabbit holes.
And then in your time with USA Field Hockey, what did you see as some factors that were impacting how things went in terms of a strength and conditioning perspective? Sleep being one, but what else was there?
Outside of sleep?
Yes.
Yeah, so we had a unique situation where most field hockey teams are sort of like around the world are like other European soccer clubs where they play for their respective professional teams and then they come together. They're decentralized. They come together for the national team events. But and in Europe, they have professional hockey leagues, but in the United States, they don't. So once you reach that level, at the time, there was really no decentralization on the women's side. So we practiced 2 days, 5 days a week all year round, unless we were in a tournament or playing some exhibition games. And so it was a really high level of training monotony, really high level of physical stress all of the time. And there's quite a bit of psychosocial stress going on too, because you don't get a chance at this every day or every weekend. You don't get a chance to perform very frequently at all, or even test yourself against outside competition. And that's difficult when you know that the time is coming, you know, at the end of a 4-year cycle where you have to qualify for the Olympics and the tournaments you do play throughout. There is a World Cup in there as well. That matters a lot, but the tournaments you do play affect your world ranking, which affects, you know, your Olympic qualification. And so super high physical stress, a lot of psychosocial stress as well. And at the end of the day, that's a field-based sport, a running sport. And that changes the outlook of what a strength program can and should look like.
Yeah. Wow. That is a lot. Okay, I'd love to let's dive into the weeds a little bit in sleep. Maybe let's start with what were your thoughts on it, kind of coming into starting this program in at the university, and then kind of what are some things that you've learned and kind of where your brain is now on it.
So, when I first started, I've always known that sleep was important. It's never was never an issue for me as an athlete because I could sleep like 10 to 14 hours a day and be fine. But when you're traveling 8, 12 time zones away, it becomes a big problem for performance. And so we were actually monitoring sleep on our players. Every night we use these piezoelectric sensors, like these little plastic pancakes that went between the mattress and box springs and connected to the player's phone. And then we worked with a company out of Israel to try to combine that with subjective wellness data and output training readiness. And of course, I know combining subjective and objective data, the scientists out there would kill me for trying to do that, I think. But you're not looking at one-off days, right? You're looking at trends over time. And there's some of the obvious stuff, like if players have high training loads and don't have a lot of sleep, soreness goes up, and then you kind of get a chicken or the egg. Like, is the soreness affecting their sleep, or is the lack of sleep creating less recovery and more impacting their soreness levels, et cetera? But we got to a point where we could break the rule of 1 hour or 1 day on the ground per hour of time zone shift in order to acclimate. We got to a point where if we were going somewhere for seven, there was 7 to 10 plus time zones away, we could cut that down by about 2 days by implementing some protocols. And we did a lot with blue light exposure during travel, really heavy detail on the travel protocol side of things. And another thing that really sparked my interest was just observationally, and I'll admit we were overextending the capabilities of our technology, but when we were at noisy hotels, or sometimes we even stayed at hostels, sometimes players would not report any sleep disturbance, but we would know that, you know, there's a considerable amount of noise coming from the hallway. And REM sleep would often be cut down by like 50%, even though total sleep time remained the same. So that made me think, you know, the longtime stance on sleep management with athletes is, and it still is, the number one way to improve any sort of sleep stage metric is to just get more total sleep time. I'm speaking outside of the pharmacological side of things. I'm somewhat skeptical of that, that's the only way. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns about sounds and smells, and the noise aspect of this equation really made me start thinking about sounds. And I think there's a pre-bed routines. I think there's a lot of stuff that can go into this that can probably affect not just total sleep time, sleep onset latency, but also sleep staging. And long-winded answer, but I'll give you an anecdote that I think is pretty fascinating. So we had a game in China and a game 6 days later at home, and we did not want to be totally acclimated to the time in China. And our players, we knew the first 2 nights after a long haul of travel would sleep really well, and then the crash was coming after that, basically because they were so tired just from the travel itself. So we made the decision to try to get wheels down in China like 36 hours before the game and play the game and then get out of China. So we were playing the game right before the crash. Total sleep time was great. REM sleep dropped off considerably, and our players were reporting that it was hard for them to even track the ball on the pitch. And that is something that we did not expect, and we ended up not playing well. Things like that can impact in international sport can impact your outcomes pretty considerably, and I think there's a lot more to be uncovered.
And then in terms of blue light exposure, is there anything that went into that more than wanting to slowly reduce it as the day goes on into the night? Or Yeah.
Yeah. So I would create travel protocols. And basically, as soon as we would get on the plane, all of our players had, they're called AO or IO, AYO glasses. And the blue light wavelength is really specific that you have to have for clinical grade research and for these outcomes. So about 470 nanometers. And that's the wavelength that these glasses emitted. And they look a little bit Star Trek-y, but all of our players would have them. And basically, as soon as we got on the airplane, we would start, if it was daylight in China, we would try to have our players get blue light exposure during that time frame. And not the whole time, like 20 to 40 minutes of exposure. And we would ask them to try their best to stay awake during those times, try their best to then sleep when it would be nighttime at our destination. At some point, there's a cutoff, but like you're not going to go waking people up on the airplane because at some point you're just compiling stress at that point. So you make an attempt. And then when you get there, getting early morning sun exposure in conjunction with aerobic exercise sort of multiplies the adjustment factor with your circadian rhythm. So doing that basically as soon as we hit the ground. And then every morning at the hotel, players would wake up, they'd have breakfast, let's say it'd be an hour and a half, 2 hours before we actually leave the hotel and go to training. They're now not getting any sunlight or blue light exposure that early in the morning. So we would have protocols leading all the way up until the matches started where they were getting blue light exposure using those glasses as well. And then also like if we had a game, let's say it was at like 3 o'clock, hitting the lull in the circadian rhythm, we would also at times either just go outside as a team, have meetings outside or give them some sort of blue light exposure protocol to try to elevate the circadian rhythm.
And then, are you a fan of melatonin?
I am. There are responders and non-responders. I am not a fan of people trying it for the first time going into competition. Some people have a lot of sleep disturbances from it. Personally, I will use it from time to time, especially after long haul travel. I'm not a fan of people just taking it forever because they like the way it puts them to sleep. I think it's a good and a safe tool for short term usage and helping adjust the circadian rhythm.
Yeah, I think that one's still so interesting because there's people on one end who are like, you don't want to take it because your body's going to start producing it. I mean, I look at some of the data, some of the world's foremost thought leaders on melatonin, they take a shitload of it like consistently. I love your answer there because that it depends, you know, it depends in terms of what you have going on and then how you specifically respond to it. So,
yeah, I've focused my lens now more on I'll throw melatonin into the pharmacological spectrum. But I focus my lens now a little bit more away from that stuff. And it's just a tool in the back pocket. I think we tend to apply these principles around the endocrine system. Like if somebody takes a lot of steroids at a really young age, it can stop their testosterone production long term. And we just throw that at melatonin like it's automatically going to happen. And I don't know. I'm not so sure that that's the truth. There's certainly research out there to say if you take it for a long time and then you stop taking it, that it's very hard for you to sleep initially, but probably goes with any kind of sleep aid.
And then with what happened to the women's field hockey team in China and, baseball players, just like, the NBA, they come in so late at night. So I know getting a great amount of sleep, sometimes great quality night of sleep can be challenging. Have you seen anything that's helpful when you don't get a good night of sleep in terms of optimizing performance? So reaction time can be improved as an example with what happened with the field hockey team.
Not yet. And this is one of the big questions. Well, so if you have an opportunity to take a nap, that can certainly help. Like, total sleep time across the entire 24-hour spectrum is ultimately like the most important thing. But our players, once they get into season, if they have a 7 p.m. game, they show up to the clubhouse around 12 or 1. They have a lift and or early work. They hit in the cages, and then they have a couple hour break until they play the game. But they're not usually leaving the clubhouse and going and taking a nap. And major league clubhouses have recovery rooms, so they often have a place they can go. But most minor leagues don't. One thing that's super prevalent in baseball is caffeine and nicotine, and trying to avoid those things late at night, especially like a pitcher that knows he's not going to be playing in the game tonight. Let's try to not be drinking coffee all throughout the game. You still run into the conundrum of like eating a heavy, high carb meal immediately before bed is going to negatively impact your sleep. High training loads in the evening are going to negatively impact your sleep. On the hydration side, we want our athletes consuming sodium post game so that they can retain more fluids. But too high of sodium before sleep can negatively impact your REM sleep. So there's a lot of, and players will call us out on this. We will try to give them sleep education, and then they'll be like, yeah, but everything you just told us we should be doing, we can't actually do. And then it becomes like, yeah, we're trying to give you the best tools possible, and you're going to have to make the decisions on your own whenever you can get it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say mindset. Say, I feel great. I slept great last night, even on the 4 hours. That's the number one thing you gotta be able to apply. At least in my experience, I don't know. I agree. I haven't seen anything else either. Yeah.
One thing I'll throw out there too is traveling. So I'm in the minor leagues right now. Monday's always the off day, and a lot of the comfort side of being at home and having your freedom on that off day is really important to the players. So they want to travel immediately post game on Sunday, and in Houston, as an example, our double A team would often have like 12 to 14 hour bus rides following that game. And now you're sleeping on a bus or not sleeping on a bus and probably stopping at a gas station or whatever fast food is open in the middle of the night to try to get something to eat. Now you're arriving at your destination at like 10 in the morning the next day. And now your sleep is all screwed up for the next 3 or 4 days. Moving that travel day to the actual off day is really helpful in terms of sleep. I do understand it is less helpful on the mental recovery side, disconnecting, being home, seeing family, whatever. So there's a trade-off, but traveling on the off day can help.
And then in your work with the short time you spent with special operators, with the field hockey players, your work with the Astros and the Red Sox, in terms of the best of the best in each of these fields, is there anything that you saw in terms of mindset or attributes that kind of you saw that really stood out that separated them from, the really, really, really good?
Yeah. Shout out Peter Habrill. He was our sports psychologist with the USOPC. He worked a lot with our team on mindfulness. And I know that's also a big thing in the military space, and whether or not the operators or the athletes know it. Peter would give the phrase that that attention is the currency of performance, and being able to not try to suppress thoughts, because your mind is going to always be producing thoughts, but recognizing when distracting thoughts are coming into your head, like I better not screw up, or I'm about to win, or I'm about to lose, or anything in between, recognizing when those thoughts are there and being able to re-anchor your attention in the moment and focus on your job, hugely important. And now there's a lot, part of mindfulness practicing also involves a lot of breathing practice as well. And there's a lot, especially in the military space, breathing practice, but really being able to constantly re-anchor your attention in the present moment, focus on exactly what you need to do, and minimizing expectations. Like, I don't mean that in terms of like you should have high expectations of yourself, but expecting a particular outcome or expecting something to end at a certain point will eventually become a distraction to you, or it'll cause you to dump everything you have into a task that is not the end game. And I think elite operators at any level, and it probably spills into the workplace too, are able to tackle those things.
So ability to control attention. And then what was the second thing that you said? Managing. So focusing on process rather really than expectation of outcome.
Exactly. Expect a lot of yourself. There's a book I'm gonna forget the name of it, but they talk about arrogant performance and humble practice, and basically being able to be very confident when you go into something, but when you are doing things in practice, being totally comfortable with scrutinizing everything that you're doing and focusing on doing it better.
And then real quick, circling back to sleep, I mentioned that guys are getting in so late, baseball players, and we're big on rituals and routines here. And is there anything that you have found in terms of nighttime routines, kind of last hour spent before officially going to sleep, that you found have been really beneficial in terms of efficiency of sleep, and then also REM sleep and deep sleep?
I think just having a routine is the most important thing. When you're traveling on the road, bringing your own pillow actually goes a long way. Having the same sort of comfort stimulus as best as you can there. For some people, it's about a bedtime routine, and obviously, you know, avoiding the social media, which I'm very bad at, to be honest. I don't typically look at my social media until I'm getting into bed. So avoiding social media, avoiding TV or anything that's stimulating like that, but mostly maintaining the same wind down routine. I think a bigger piece that often gets overlooked is actually having a routine before you leave the ballpark or leave work or leave wherever you're at. As soon as you bring that stuff home with you, then it becomes another distraction that can weigh on you all the way until you go to sleep, and you're now not being present with your family. And then those things can pile up and become another stressor on their own. And for some people, you need to they need venting, but for some people, like, venting would be, or even just recapping their day could be potentially reliving stressors. So that's individual specific. There's a lot of research out there around journaling, and I'm a big fan of that. I think if you, and not on a computer, actually handwriting, but journaling. And if you've got some form of stress that is related to the sport or work or wherever you're at, that is your place to put it down, close the book, and go home. And it makes it a lot easier to leave that there and come back to it the next day.
Yeah, I love the idea of having a transition. I mean, you know, not even we using it in this context when leaving the workplace so you can get a good night of sleep if you're leaving late. But I mean, transition before you go into a training session, or transition before whatever it is, to be able to have these rituals and routines, you know, keep them brief, but create them. I think there's so much going on with our subconscious and our body that having stuff like that is a lot more power than we realize.
Yeah, I like to call it dropping the bone, like a dog carrying around a bone all day. Drop it, leave it on the floor. It'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, cool, Nick. As we wrap this up, I'd love to do some rapid fire with you. Biggest mentor that you've had in your life?
Steve Hill. He was my my speed trainer when I was growing up for many years. He was a former strength coach with the Giants and Redskins. Got 3 Super Bowls with them.
And for those that are listening to this that would want to incorporate sprinting into their routine, how many days a week? How many sprints for how long?
Oof. I'll pretend that we're not in season here. I would say sprinting 3 times a week, at absolute minimum once every 4 days. And the volume and total distance should really be progressing from like shorter accelerations to more top end speed work. But I would keep any intra-session volume for non-track athletes. Typically under 300 yards. Realistically, with baseball players, we're looking at about 150 total yards.
Yeah, 150 can feel pretty long.
That's total across repetitions, not 150 meter sprint or 150 yard sprint.
Okay. Best book or research paper that you've read in the past year that you found most helpful to you?
Creating Magic. It's golly, now I'm going to forget the guy's name, but the title is Creating Magic. It's from one of the former CEOs of Disney. Disneyland.
Was that Bob Iger's book or no?
No, I could Google it real quick.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'll figure it out. I can Google it too. We can all know. Okay. And then biggest habit that you've added or taken away that's had the habit that you've added or taken away in your life that's had the biggest impact in the past year?
Beautiful question. Working out in the morning. I've always been a person that, like, on my way to work, like as soon as I get in the car, stress kicks in. What do I have to do today? And I've always been an afternoon workout person. But actually recently here in spring training, I started working out in the morning, and it kind of started because I have a 1-year-old at home and she's not going to be up when I leave for work anyways. But if I work out in the afternoon, I'll miss her going to bed too. So I kind of started that. But it has drastically changed my mood for the day. It has definitely positively impacted my workouts as well. Been a big stress reliever to kind of just ground me before the day started.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, there's I think his last name is Brady, but there's a great guy who wrote a book just on that specific idea of exercise early in the morning because you get a 12-hour mood boost from it.
Yeah.
Cool. And Nick, I know you're in the trenches with a pro MLB baseball team, Boston Red Sox. But what is the best place where people can connect with you on social media?
Probably my Twitter. I check that the most often. I hardly ever post, especially during spring training. I try to do a little bit more outside of that. But yeah, just DM me on Twitter. I've had a few people reach out to me on LinkedIn. I try to be as responsive as I can to everybody that reaches out, but I don't check my LinkedIn, but like once a month or so. So yeah, find me on Twitter, and I think it's just Nick_Shed.
That's awesome. Nick, thank you so much for coming on Super Athlete Radio.
Thank you for having me.